ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Oscar Wilde wrote, "One should always be in love. That is the reason one should never marry." And those words appear at the start of The Invite, the new film from actor and Booksmart director Olivia Wilde, starring Wilde herself, Seth Rogen, Ed Norton and Penelope Cruz, about a married couple in trouble and the pair of swingers from the upstairs apartment who suggest how to rekindle the flame. Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show and The Invite is where we begin this week's episode. A warning, there's an F-bomb ahead.
We only get a few chances for meaningful relationships in life.
What is going on here?
This is fucking crazy!
Can we please do a reset?
Is this from a podcast?
Yes, it is.
We did come down here tonight to invite you.
Invite us to join us.
First things first, you don't cast Seth Rogen in your marriage comedy if you're going to burn the house down. You'd probably want Adam Driver for that. And The Invite, although it is about a deep existential crisis for this married couple, is a hopeful film. Wilde and Rogen play Joe and Angela, a 40-ish San Francisco couple who've been falling out of love for a long time. And Norton and Cruz, sporting a blonde bombshell bob, are the neighbours from upstairs, Pina and Hawk, not his real name, who keep everyone in the building awake with their vigorous lovemaking. When Angela invites them over for a soiree of cheese and charcuterie, much to Joe's annoyance, it's not long before some tequila and a jazz cigarette are also imbibed, and Pina and Hawk are encouraging the married couple to peel back the layers of their resentments and disappointments. And it turns out they have come with an invitation of their own, much to Joe's surprise.
You, her, and me.
Yes.
Me too.
Yes, also you.
Adapted from a Spanish film by Cesc Gay and also inspired, according to Wilde, by the teachings of celebrity sex therapist Esther Perel, The Invite is a serious comedy about men who crowd out intimacy and women who can't communicate their desires. There are bursts of screwball dialogue, awkward physical comedy, shouting matches, and a touch of tragedy. And the energy rarely flags. Olivia Wilde's performance, especially in close-up, is a portrait of repressed emotions finally breaking the surface. Rogen, meanwhile, plays his character's cards closer to his chest. He's a high school music teacher who's dead inside, long past his moment of youthful glory in a semi-successful band, whose one hit gathers dust next to the record player, never to be removed from its sleeve again. Norton and Cruz, meanwhile, navigate their characters' pivots in the final act very well. This invite is one you should accept. It will send you off with a smile after traumatizing you just a little bit. The Invite is out wide in cinemas this week.
I'm getting emotional. I don't know why, but I thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, it has.
It's got great energy.
Wow, look at that.
Energy is what I was going for. That's what I wanted.
Energy's great. We talked a lot about how to capture energy as though that was a real thing we could do.
Well, energy is everything.
Really?
Kinetic, chemical, potential, nuclear, sexual. You cannot really create it or destroy it, but you can find ways to shape it.
Mm. Beautiful.
You shaped it really beautifully here. I love the shape.
Thank you.
Too existential for you, Joe?
No, hey, not existential enough for me. Let's get deep. What is life?
You're listening to The Screen Show. My name's Jason DeRosso. I'm going to discuss two works now that focus on the relationship between humans and nature. One is a film about a giant tree and three different generations who have all enjoyed the shade of its massive branches, but it's also about how people learn to communicate with nature and plants in particular. The other is a virtual reality work that enables you, once you put on the headset, to get to know the survivors of the catastrophic 2022 floods in Australia's eastern states while putting you in the houses of these people, literally, and experiencing what it's like as the waters are rising around you. The film, though, is where we begin, and it's called Silent Friend. It's written and directed by my next guest, Hungarian filmmaker Ildikó Enyedi. Now, you might remember her 2017 film, which was called On Body and Soul. That was an unconventional love story about a pair of abattoir employees who, at night, unbeknownst to each other, dream the same dream, in which they are together as a pair of deer in a forest. In her new film, Enyedi is interested once again in what I'd describe as decentering human perspective. And she tells a story in three chapters, more or less rotating around a German university, the one constant being a tree and a growing awareness of how nature communicates to us. Now, in the current day, there's a chapter involving Tony Leung, who plays a researcher who's visiting from Hong Kong and during the COVID lockdown is shut down in this university alone, except for a rather antagonistic and monosyllabic German caretaker. Now, with the help of a French scientist, played by Léa Seydoux, who he converses with via Zoom, he starts trying to measure what he believes are signs of this huge tree's neurological activity. He believes it's thinking and reacting to him. Meanwhile, at the turn of the century in black and white, we meet the university's first female student, a botany enthusiast who faces cruel discrimination as a woman and finds an alternative passion involving natural photography. Then we're in the 1970s amidst radical student sit-ins, and we meet a socially awkward young man who discovers that plants can communicate to him, and he even sets up an electronic rig by which they can start to perform simple tasks and impact the physical spaces around them via electromagnetic pulses. Now, Silent Friend screened in competition at the Venice Film Festival last year, where it was awarded the Critics' Prize. I'm a little surprised by this. I don't think it necessarily works completely. It is a patchy film, but it's a very interesting one. Surprisingly, perhaps, it's, formally speaking, not as nutty as you'd expect. And although there is one long last shot, it's not as if, formally speaking, we're witnessing any particularly groundbreaking cinematic techniques here. If you cast your mind back to Skolimowski's film about a donkey, which was essentially about a donkey's travels through, well, various places, and it was a film told through the perspective of that donkey. It was called Io. I highly recommend you track it down, by the way. That was a much more formally interesting work. Silent Friend is at times quite conventional in its storytelling, and at times that storytelling is really quite compelling. The pseudoscience in each of the three stories, the pseudoscience three ways, as it were, is often expressed in flourishes of graphic design and animation. You can imagine there are lots of pulsating chromatic patterns set to abstract orchestral music or even classical music, Wagner in particular. There are computer readouts that fill the screen and botanical diagrams. The black and white feminist chapter, I suppose you could call it, unfolds in the most dramatically satisfying way, while the other two chapters are a little more languid. Overall, the film is a slow burn, and you will enjoy it depending on how open you are to this kind of hypothetical. It's not as captivating or as tightly constructed as On Body and Soul, but it's worth a look, especially if this philosophical terrain sounds like your cup of chai. Ildikó Enyedi was in Sydney recently for jury duty at the Sydney Film Festival. I caught up with her then. She's coming up.
What if they observe us the same way we observe them?
Was tust du denn? Das ist mein Garten.
Wissen Sie, die Professoren waren eher entsetzt darüber, dass die Universität dieses Jahr auch Damen die Möglichkeit einer Bewerbung einräumt.
Ja, das war für mich auch recht offensichtlich.
What would you do if you want to connect with a being but have no common language?
What I want to test is not so complex.
Ildikó Enyedi, welcome to the Screen Show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
This seems to me to be like a film that is almost unhappy with a kind of classical storytelling and wants to, because it's not up to telling or describing the concepts you want to describe. And you are inventing a slightly different way of looking at the world, of telling a story in film because of the contents of this story. Would you agree? Is this where it comes from? Is a kind of desire to expand what storytelling can be in terms of characters and plot and tension?
Yeah, rather expand than being unhappy with storytelling. It is simply using time in cinema differently, putting the accent instead of the plot on the experience. And because we are wired very strongly to focus on the plot, on the story, the same way as we are wired to focus on a face, this film offers a sort of glimpse into an other way of notion of time, feeling yourself in the world. For example, a tree, which is the protagonist of our film. So somehow, with the very tender nudges, just to make aware the audience, and hopefully on an enjoyable way, that our limits or human senses are not the default. It's just one of the many.
Tell me about why you decided on these three stories that unfold in three different time periods. You have a young woman who's the first to be admitted to her university at the beginning of the 1900s. Then we're in the 70s and we're amongst the student radicals on campus, and it's the story of a lonely man who's not very good with romance. And then we're in the period of COVID, and Tony Leung plays a neuroscientist who comes to Germany. So he's a migrant in a sense, and there's lockdown and the solitude of that. So why those three?
Oh, actually, how you summarize the film is already that sort of rationalizing, putting in order something. What you discover very differently in the film, and I feel a bit sorry. Of course, you are not the first one. It's the general way of approaching the film. It's much more interesting for those who don't know anything of the film. Enter in the cinema, sit down, see a very alive university campus in Germany at the beginning of 2020 in the winter. Then the COVID comes, and then there is a scientist stuck in this empty campus. And this sort of emptiness, which is actually filled with beings, because when you think that you are alone in a botanical garden, you are among a bunch of super interesting beings, the trees, the plants. Then time opens up and you wander in different time periods. That's how, if you are lucky enough and you haven't read anything about the film and you wander in the cinema, that's when what you live through. And then the film is gliding between different timelines. But returning to your question, why I picked these other two moments, or these three moments, in fact, the whole film is about perception, the human perception, the more than human perception, how an animal, a bat, a bee, or a plant perceives the world. But I also wanted to make us aware how radically, even in such a short time as 120 years, human perception changed. The 70s, it was really about reinventing how we approach the world around us and how we position ourselves in it. That was a really beautifully bold and very naive period. The same goes for the turn of the 20th century, when that sort of very seemingly solid faith that the world is controllable,
that if you research long enough and if you are working enough, then you can put every little insect and every little phenomena in a little box, and you can make lists and tick them out. And this faith started to crumble around that time, also in science, also in everyday life. We see this happening. And 2020, all of us lived through that sort of time out when everyone had time to rethink our position in the world. And also because of the danger, it was tense enough to be motivated to think about that.
What's your personal belief system with regards to the natural world? You watch this film and you would think this is made by a Buddhist, or perhaps, you know, that certainly it's made by someone very interested in nature and a kind of decentering of human beings as the central focus of affairs. Is that your position?
I have a very big curiosity. I have a very strong wish to communicate also with other humans, and it's not always easy, even with humans. It's not by chance that in the film we have also some language barriers between the human protagonists. And I am extremely curious of the modern human life forms. You are just sitting in the middle of a huge conversation, totally ignorant that it is happening around you. It was very attractive and very thrilling for me, actually for my teenage years. And I follow researches of plant communication, animals communication for decades. And actually, what is very surprising, that in natural sciences, in biology, in neurology, in the last 15, 20 years, more and more often, people just say, wow, isn't it a sort of Buddhist approach? I'm not a Buddhist. I am absolutely amazed by that sort of approach to the world. My roots are very deeply European. My limits, I'm very aware of my limits. But this was, for example, the aspect of the script, which was from the first read very evident for Tony Leung, who is a practicing Buddhist. So he saw that sort of energy behind the script, and it was a wonderful surprise for me that this was, in a way, more interesting for him and more important for him than his own storyline.
Yeah, he's such an interesting casting choice and a very good casting choice. Léa Seydoux is the other very high-profile actor that's in this film, and she's in that Tony Leung's character's timeline. How did you come to cast?
I had a film which was, by the way, shown also here in Sydney, The Story of My Wife. It was in competition in Cannes, and she was the protagonist of that film. It was a great experience to work together. So somehow I was in the position to ask her for this relatively small role in this film, because I really needed someone comparably charismatic and with the same weight of screen presence as Tony Leung. And this storyline, this neuroscientist played by Tony Leung is wandering into a new territory, biology and plant communication, where he's an amateur. He is looking for a mentor. So Léa played this mentor with a very convincing way. And it's a little fun fact for Australians that the blueprint for her character is actually a wonderful, wonderful scientist, Monica Galliano, who is working, I think, for several decades already in Australia. She's originally Italian, but all her research she's doing in Australia. Her lectures, TED Talks are available online. So I just really encourage everyone to listen to them because she is an incredible personality. The philosophy behind her whole approach to her field of science is amazing.
And Tony Leung, how did you cast him?
I wrote this role for Tony. I needed someone who is not just a brilliant actor, but also a full personality who has something to do with this neuroscientist who I was thinking about. I've seen an interview with Tony, a simple interview. Of course, I followed his career for many years from the early films. I think it was even of his Marvel films, so not an art house film. And somehow it touched me so much how truthful and real he was in this interview, how much he took this interview not as something that, you know, you have to deliver a certain amount of information during this promotion tours, but was really looking with the real curiosity.
He was engaged.
He just wanted to have a real human conversation. He listened to the question, thought about it really, and answered as a truthful person without any shield and any premeditation. And it touched me very, very deeply. It's rare in his status and in this sort of situations. So I guessed behind a brilliant actor, there is also a wonderful person.
Ildiko Agnetti, her new film Silent Friend is screening around the country in limited release. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. Nature is not always a silent friend, of course, and as Lars von Trier reminded us, sometimes nature is Satan's church. Maybe that's a bit hyperbolic. Sometimes nature is simply a silent foe. And in the very accomplished, vividly assembled virtual reality work by my next two guests, the silent foe is floodwater. It's floodwater that rises slowly but inexorably and threatens the homes of several interviewees who take part in this virtual reality project. They live in various parts of the country and they experienced flooding back in 2022. The work is called The World Came Flooding In and it's by Isabel Knowles and Van Sarawine. It's a work that combines interviews with flood survivors with reconstructions of their homes that you're allowed to experience as the waters rise around them. The focus of the work is all about the emotional link that people forge with their houses, their belongings. And in the interviews, we hear very reflective and philosophical musings about a sense of place, about ownership, about memory, and about loss. It's a powerful work. I got to don the headset last year at the Australian Centre for the Moving Image during the Melbourne International Film Festival, and I was very moved. It's touring around the country. I'll tell you more about where after the interview, but you can find out details at the website isabelandvan.com. Isabel and Van are coming up.
Have you ever thought about what would remain if your house was flooded? At what point would you decide to leave, surrendering everything to the path of the water?
We looked out at the beautiful silvery haze coming down, but it just didn't stop. It kept getting louder, never easing off.
That's one of the first things I cleaned after the water went back down.
The
house had PowerPoints set to what was meant to be the maximum flood height. The official warnings said the water wouldn't reach that level.
In 2022, Australia experienced our worst and most widespread recorded flood disaster. The climate emergency is flooding little by little into all of our lives. A house is never the same after a river has run through it.
Isabel Knowles and Van Sarrewine, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Now, the genesis of this project is a near-death experience off Brunswick Heads. Could you tell me about that experience and how it affected you so deeply and maybe inspired you eventually to make this work?
Yeah, it was a really intense experience. Isabel and I went for a work trip to Ocean Shores near Byron Bay, and as we landed, we were all excited because we're from Melbourne. The weather in Melbourne is, you know, pretty grey and horrible, and we were heading up to beautiful, sunny northern New South Wales. The weather seemed quite foreboding, but we ended up going to the beach, and anyway, I won't go into too much detail, but we ended up going in just up to our knees and then basically just found ourselves pulled into a rip, and it was a really intense experience. I don't think I've ever felt so close to death before, basically, because I panicked, and I'm a strong swimmer, and I realised that this is a situation where people die because there were no lifeguards. There were lots of people. There were people surfing. There were people playing in the shallows, but suddenly I just couldn't touch the ground. I felt like I was in a giant washing machine, and I also have terrible eyesight. I wasn't wearing my glasses, so I couldn't see if anyone could see me. It was actually for me kind of an empowering experience too, because I basically had to talk myself out of a panic and tell myself to just start swimming, to swim parallel to the shore like I'd always been taught, and to start swimming and swimming and swimming. And basically as I did that, I started to feel waves wash me forward back to the shore, and that was one of the most sort of powerful experiences of my life, just feeling that I had escaped near death. But it didn't end there, because I came out onto the shore and couldn't see Isabel and another friend, and turned around and saw that they were also caught in this rip being swept out to sea. And I also had a terrible feeling that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't save them because I would die if I went back out there again. Thank goodness another workmate turned up at that moment with a surfboard. So I immediately sent him out, and he managed to rescue Isabel and our colleague. And, we were all saved. But yeah, it was just a really very intense, life-changing experience that really made me realise about the power of water and how, you know, things can seem calm, fine, and all of a sudden you go from swimming at a beautiful beach to nearly dying.
It's interesting how much I think filmmakers especially have cottoned on to the power of water as an image and a symbol. I mean, I can think of how many films are sort of set on boats or sinking ships or how people sort of lost at sea or in really wet, watery storms often appear on screen. I think it does evoke this sense of a universal sense of panic, really, or of powerlessness. Was that playing on your mind, you know, over the following months? I mean, was it something you'd return to again and again and talk about, that experience?
I don't know if we talked about it a whole lot together since, like, a little bit here and there, because obviously it had a lot of impact, but like with any very disturbing thing, you often want to think about nicer things. You know, there was something just so incredibly lonely about being in that position as well, being one little person floating around in a giant sea of water. You just feel how enormous it is and how strong it is compared to your own strength. And I think it was when the flood started happening and, you know, stories of people kind of having to escape that sort of similar situation. Of course, it's not the same. A flood's really different to the ocean, and we don't have experience of escaping a flood, so it's obviously going to be different. But there's something about the power of water that hit home watching those stories on the news. And also,
you got caught up in some of those floods though, didn't you?
Yeah, and also visiting a lot of places in 2022 for different projects and work and things. Maitland, Byron Bay, Mullumbimby, each of those places either flooded the day after we visited or was flooding while we were there. So we sort of weren't inundated ourselves, but were very, very close to it and saw sort of the impacts on the communities.
Do you think if you hadn't been caught in those rips, in that rip off Brunswick Heads, you wouldn't have connected in such a deep or profound way with the plight of people caught amongst rising floodwaters?
Yeah, I think it really, it affects your body and your mind in such a way that it's just like it brings it right back to the foreground. Like even watching a film, I think I watched Tim Winton's film about surfing soon after, and it was just like, I just couldn't look at it. That feeling just surfaces so easily. So I think definitely it made a response in us that may not otherwise have.
Yeah. So you begin a series of community creative workshops with flood survivors. Is that how it begins? And did you know what would come out of these gatherings?
No, so it was a really interesting process because we also had friends who were flood affected, but we really wanted to reach out to a wider range of people and communities. And we actually worked with a trauma-informed process consultant who talked to us about the importance when you're interviewing people or talking to people of doing things with your hands, of not, you know, really just having just an intense conversation, but, you know, if you can be doing something together, making something together. And because we're artists and we've run workshops before, we devised workshops where people could recreate a piece of furniture that they lost in floods. And we were able to run workshops at Lismore Regional Gallery where we sort of had no idea how this would go. You know, we sort of came up with this idea, and I think I was going to say before with the experience of near drowning, that also I think created a lot of empathy for people who've gone through these experiences. So we devised these workshops and had no idea how they would go, just as a way to kind of meet people who are flood affected from different areas and perhaps begin to work with them on our project.
Were they all considered traumatised? You say you met with a trauma counsellor. Did they all identify in some way as suffering from some kind of, you know, post-traumatic stress, or did it depend?
We didn't really put that into the marketing material or anything. It was really sort of just an open call to anybody who'd experienced a flood in any kind of way to come and participate in a workshop.
Yeah.
But we realised, you know, going to a community where they've had many incidents that, you know, it might not be an easy topic for people, so that's why we sought the help of the trauma-informed consultant. Mm.
The workshops were absolutely incredible. The really unexpected part of it for me was how positive everyone felt about it. And even though they were talking about very difficult things, people were so open about their experiences, and people absolutely loved remaking furniture. And then we photograph it, so they take a photo of it home, and we also 3D scan it so we could put it into virtual reality to be able to kind of then put on a headset and walk around and re-experience that furniture. And it was almost as if, I think it's like there's a memory locked inside of you that we were able to kind of help people refine by kind of remaking an object and really kind of find joy in, as well as, you know, acknowledging the difficulty of losing those objects.
VR initially was, you were conceiving it as a tool for these people to deal with the grief of losing material possessions at first, everything that those material possessions symbolised.
The project was devised as part of a lab which was about creating an immersive work that was a documentary work, and mm-hmm. we have worked with virtual reality before, and if it's done well, it can be an absolutely incredible experience that really resonates and stays with you in a very deep way. And I think because we'd had these really intense experiences with water, we then were drawn to making an experience that looked at those ideas, both for people who had been flood affected, but also for people who haven't, because we also, you know, were very aware that people were being flooded in areas that had never been flooded before. It was also we were very concerned about the climate crisis and being aware of, you know, the massive impact it's going to have on all of us. And flooding is something that can, you know, affect many or most of us in various ways. So, yeah, so the VR, we were sort of interested in that as a medium to tell a story, both for flood-impacted people and those who haven't been affected directly.
Yeah, well, that's certainly, I mean, I'm in that second category when I experienced the VR work called The World Came Flooding In, which is a great, really evocative title, by the way, because that's what you feel like, right? So when I put on that headset, and I experienced that moment in one of the houses that's been recreated where I climb up, well, you're encouraged to climb up on top of a mound of furniture in order to gain height as the water is rising around you. I must admit at that point, you really do feel something visceral about your desire to survive at all costs as a human being amidst this kind of unknowable but very threatening kind of natural occurrence. And, you know, the fear that goes along with that too, it is really quite evocative. I mean, it's the immersive quality of it, isn't it, as that water is rising?
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of, yeah, I mean, watching a film can really give you a great sense of things, but actually being surrounded by something and experiencing as if you were there is, there's not as much like that anywhere else.
And the other thing I should add with our virtual reality, we have a stop motion animation background. So we have always made films and installations where we recreate worlds in miniature so that you have something that is both real but clearly a replica, clearly, you know, 1 degree removed from maybe just classic film. So for The World Came Flooding In, we developed a process where we could 3D scan miniature models with our phones and then blow them up to life size and put them into virtual reality. As Isabel said, when you put on the headset and you go into these spaces, they're really emotional also because they're clearly paper recreations that are handmade recreations, but they're blown up and they look really familiar, but they also look it's like something you've never seen before at the same time.
There's something maybe to be gained out of the lack of detail as well, because when they're blown up, you don't feel like you're in a dollhouse or anything. You do feel like you're in a space that's, you know, that you're inhabiting as a normal sized human being, but there's a slight fuzziness or a slight sort of abstraction to everything. So it's both handmade and slightly abstract at the same time, which seems to, I don't know, combine to be quite effective. What do you think that's about? Have you had many people try and describe to you what their experience is like walking around these virtual spaces?
Well, we were really drawn to the artifacts that happen when you use this technology to scan something small, because it's designed for things that are life size. So when we're scanning miniatures, it loses a lot of detail and becomes fuzzy. And we were really drawn to the kind of holes that appear in the surfaces, because we felt like that was really similar to the holes that appear in your memory as you're trying to recall different places and events. And especially when we were doing the workshops, you know, we had people recreating their pieces of furniture, colouring it in with textures and thinking, oh, I can't remember if it was green or brown. I can't remember if this bit went like this or that. And so this kind of ambiguity that happens when you try and remember something really ties in with the aesthetic of what we've created visually.
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it, actually, because you do feel like you're in someone's memory rather than a recreation of an actual event in a photorealistic way. That being said, are there moments when people have to take off their headset and go, no, this is too much?
We've worked really hard to try and be as caring and gentle throughout the experience as possible. So we've got a narrator. It actually ended up being Isabel, who's got a beautiful voice for radio.
I've been told.
You do have a beautiful voice.
No, for sure.
And it's really soothing and calm, and it talks you through it. And we've also provided lots of ways that people can not engage if it's too much. So particularly there is a scene towards the end of the experience where you do experience a flood and there's, you know, actual water rising in a room, and there's an option to escape that scene if you need to. So you can press the VR trigger and fast forward so that you don't have to experience that if you don't want to. So yeah, we have very much built that into the experience. And as a result, we showed it to maybe 200 people when it showed at MIFF, and we've shown it at other international film festivals. And I think there's only been one or two people who've found it a bit too much at various points.
Yeah, and also there's just lovely testimony from flood survivors who talk about the objects that they lost and the homes that they had, and all of that's quite warm, actually. It's very, I don't know, universally appealing hearing people talk about their places of residence, their homes, and it's quite affecting when you realise that in many cases those homes are no longer standing. It's a great experience, I think. Thanks, Isabel and Van, for coming on and talking to me about that work.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Isabel Knowles and Van Sauerwine, co-creators of the highly moving VR work When the World Came Flooding In, which you can experience at various places around the country at the moment, at the Ipswich Art Gallery up until the end of August. At the end of August as well, at the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney. In September, you can experience it at the Buku Arts Centre at Yirrkala. And from October to December, you can see it at the Northern Rivers Community Gallery at Ballina. And you can also don the headset at the Museum of Australian Photography in Melbourne from November 26th to February next year. There will be other places that will come up on this tour as well. To keep in touch with where it's heading, just head to the website of Isabel and Van. That's at isabelandvan.com. Or you can check out the website of the Museum of Australian Photography, which has had a key role in getting the work touring around the country. That is it for another episode of The Screen Show. Thanks as ever to Sarah Corbett. I'm Jason DeRosso. Until next time, bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.